Okay, let's assume that I was just talking to myself. I will go over things. This is the Limar Technical Net established back in 1982 by Dick K2RIW, and there were many other people involved as well. And I am now Net Control Operator. My name is Roy, and I am AC2GS. The Technical Net has some facts that I like to remind people of. If you have any mailbag questions, if you have any questions but you can't get onto the net on the radio, or if you have any topics, or if you have any puzzles, or if you would like me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at some space-related bit of news or video and comment upon it, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Links to articles of interest or articles that are brought up throughout this technical net will be available on my link page, roy.ac2gs.com. I already have a few articles listed, so take a look at them. It might be of interest to you. Again, it's roy.ac2gs.com. The chat room is open for business, and that's available. You just have to type into your browser, chat.ac2gs.com, and you'll get there. Hopefully, we're streaming this via the internet. All you have to do is type your browser to technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you the entrance into our internet stream for those people who don't have a radio that can receive us and the echo. And also, I'd like to mention that MyKP2NJI is maintaining his archive of the technical net at his website, amateurradio.tv. So you go there, and there's archives going all the way back to September of 2006. They're very interesting, and I recommend them highly. So let me drop for a second, and we will go on with the show. Okay. What we're going to be doing, hopefully, is the technical portion of the TechNet somewhere between now and 9 p.m. Anywhere from 8:30 to 9, hopefully we will have the pleasure to be joined by Andy, WA2CDL, with the next installment in Andy's Corner that will be discussing more about impedance. Then we will continue with questions if there are any. We have a mailbag question that's not exactly amateur radio related, but we'll get to that in its time. And I might even have a puzzler for you guys and gals. And then we will have Paul with the space report. So, if you have any questions of a technical nature, please give us your call sign and your first name.
It's Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu. It's not a question, it's a comment. My name is Rich.
Gosh, Rich, you think you have to remind me of your name. Well, what do you have to say, Rich?
No, I'm just following the rules. You said, you know, give us a call sign and your name, so I follow rules. The comment is, surprise, surprise, about digital radio. Now, let me tell you what I found out. It's about a month that I'm struggling with it and enjoying it. Now I'm enjoying it. Some struggle also, but it's about a month now. So I have a pretty good feel for what it is and what it isn't. And let me drop. I hope somebody's interested. Let me drop.
I'm interested.
I've been a ham radio, licensed ham radio operator for 60 years. That's 60 years. So I came up through the 60s and 70s. Where there were what we called CISOs. And I had forgotten what a real CISO, how enjoyable a real CISO could be. And that's what digital has brought back. There's nobody, except for a certain occasions, there's some fighting with Grandmeister and TGIF and DMARC and some of the other ones, some infighting. But basically, things are friendly enough to get two, three, maybe four guys in on a 20-minute QSO, half-hour QSO I had, And I really missed what that was all about. To me, that was ham radio operators, ham radio at its best. Let me let it drop. Not just signal strength and weather report and okay? It was a real exchange of ideas of not only technical radio like Andy's Corner, but I was fascinated talking to guys like Andy who really knew that type of stuff. But it was also about ham radio in general. It was about equipment in general. It was about life in general. And that's what digital is bringing back. And I got to tell you, I'm a satisfied customer. It takes a little hard to get into some of it, like DMR, but the 2 weeks you have to spend, like I did, to fight it, to finally figure out what's going on, is well worth it. Just some thoughts, guys. Back to Ned.
Well, Rich, I'm glad you're having fun there. You sound enthusiastic, and that's great. Maybe you want to tell people of the some of the talk groups that you find the most entertaining and enlightening. I've been kind of listening to the side, and I noticed that this very night, we talked at once upon a time that no one kind of moves off the talk group to another talk group, and I heard you and a guy moving off of talk group 91 just about an hour or two ago.
Well, actually, that's interesting. We were on, the guy I was talking to got it reversed. He wanted to go to 3100. We were on 3100 and wanted to go to 91, but he got it mixed up. We were already on 91. I'm confusing this. But we were already on 91. He thought we should QSY from 3100 to 91, and that was the mix-up. What's happened is, Brandmeister, and this might not be understandable to guys who haven't delved into digital yet, Brandmeister has shut down 310, 311, TAC 312, 13, 14, to whatever, for simplex. Only duplex now, because it was just supposed to be a place to meet up, a talk group to meet up and say, let's QSY to, 314567, whatever. But people were using it to have two shows on, and that's not what its intention was. So I guess about a year ago now, they shut it down for simplex. I didn't realize that, because I'm just finding out what simplex and duplex are. Now I know, what the whole thing is about. I was just reading some old stuff about it. Go ahead.
Okay, very good, Rich. From the way I was hearing the conversation, it sounded like that guy, Charlie, kind of knew he was on Talk Group 91. He at first wanted you to go to Talk Group 3100, and you mentioned that 3100 is rather busy as well, so I think he mentioned something like 313, and then both of you left Talk Group 91.
I went to 31. I thought he still wanted to go to 3100, and that's what I did. Then I came back to 91 to see if he was still there, and that's when that guy came in. I'm pretty sure I have this right. Said you are on Talk Group 91, and you are on Talk Group 91, and I don't know where he went. I couldn't raise him after that. But basically, it's an infinite amount. They're just like frequency. It's just like QSYing to a frequency. As long as the frequency's open, you got it. You can talk till the cows come home, as long as you check. And it's wonderful like that. Nobody's telling you when to, that you're talking too long. If the talk group isn't busy, and, if what you're saying is appropriately ham radio subject. And I don't even think there's anybody there, maybe just some regular guys, but there's no regulatory basis for it. There is a new talk group, by the way, that's bringing in all five of them. I'll get the number in a second, Roy.
Okay, very good, Rich. I used last heard to try and figure out where you had gone from Talk Group 91. And according to Brandmeister, you had registered, you had hit the push to talk on Talk Group 1. I'm not even familiar with what Talk Group 1 is, if it's a really legitimate talk group or just some kind of, command code for something else. But if you can kind of give some pointers to people out there, you know, they might be not used to really using their DMR much. They might be just using it locally. So if you can spread the wealth and give people talk groups to check out and listen to, and if they feel that it fits them, they can join in as well.
There aren't too many, so why don't I do this for next week? I'll write down a list of the most popular ones, like the Worldwide Talk Group and the North American Talk Group and some of the other ones, and some of the newer ones that people really don't know about. I mean, they're getting very specialized. There's a net on a talk group about cooking. I don't know how many of us are into cooking. I'm not. I'm just into cooking finals. Or should I say smoking finals? Anyway, I'll make a list and run it down quickly next week so guys know what is actually going on digital subject-wise or content-wise. So I'll do that next week. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, very good, Rich. I look forward to that. Always like to hear of active talk group rooms reflectors. People who are interested in D-Star tend to think in terms of reflectors, and people who are interested in YAESU Fusion Digital Technology think in terms of room, and people with DMR tend to think in terms of talk groups. But they're so interlinked with each other these days that if you have something like a hotspot or BlueDB that I'm playing with a small AMBI chip in your computer, you can pretty much hit almost any talk group reflector or room out there. It's amazing. And it's all due to so many different people who take the trouble of hooking in their own little servers to link one backbone network to another. So it's an interesting culture out there. If you haven't looked into it before, you might want to. As I've mentioned before, if you have a cell phone, an Android cell phone, there's an application that's free that's called Peanut. And it lets you link into about 20, 30 different talk group reflector rooms. If you like the sound of it, then you might want to upgrade to either a ThumbDB and BlueDB on your PC, or a hotspot and a DMR or any other digital radio technology. So digital radio is here to stay. It's a little complicated. It's a little confusing, but we're here to help if you need any. And thanks, Rich, for adding that. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. So if you have any technical questions or topics you would like to discuss tonight, please give us your first name and your call sign. Okay, this is going to be a very quiet night. Ken, if you're out there, let's do the mailbag question. But as long as you're around, you can tell me in your own words.
Okay, thank you, Roy. Okay, I guess my question was about a COVID concern and certain foods, particularly sushi. I'm trying to decide if I really want to embark on sushi because I feel the fish may have been handled by a number of people. I'm considering I go to a sushi restaurant, I order something that requires tuna, chef number one comes, hacks off a piece of tuna, puts the big piece back in the case and makes my food. Roy comes back in, he wants something with tuna. Sushi chef number two grabs the piece of tuna, cuts a piece off, puts it back in. I don't know, Andy comes in, he wants pieces of tuna again. Sushi chef number three touches that piece of fish, makes what Andy wants. I've now got a piece of fish that's been touched by three sushi chefs. So I'm wondering what people's opinion are. Is are they anxious to touch a piece of fish that's been handled by so many people? AC2GS, WB2KWC.
Okay, thank you very much, Ken, and I'd be interested in other people's opinion as I wrote you back. This is kind of a problem in general of fresh delivered meals and such. It's less of a problem in cooked meals because the heat process will kind of correct any early damage. You're only left with the delivery guy, and that's about it for the most part. But as you mentioned, sushi is raw fish. There's no heat treatment. There's no sterilization process that's going on. So I would imagine that you are at a somewhat higher risk of contamination and infection. That being said, most of the research that I've seen, although it speaks of novel ways of catching the infection, the overwhelming majority seem to be still person-to-person. Intermediate contact through touched objects seems to be rather low, but these are unfortunately not complete studies. So my bottom line is, yeah, it puts you at a slightly greater risk. It sort of depends on how risky you want to live your life through and how important sushi is to you. And I could see someone making a case for either end of the spectrum. Especially, thankfully, now New York City's infectious rate appears to be going down, which is a very good sign. So we're at less risk for the time being. This is always subject to change. So if anyone else has any other opinions on this subject, please give me your call sign.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou. And by the way, Lou, do we have IRLP tonight?
I don't know. I'll check. My suggestion is cover it with wasabi.
Well, it's a funny answer, and is not a antiseptic agent. It just feels like one in your mouth.
Did you log into RLP see if we're on the server?
I didn't log in because I don't have access. I look at it from the web page, and I just see Canada. I don't see us.
And we're not connected. Let me see if I can do something.
WS2X.
Yes, Paul.
Good evening, Roy. When you go to a supermarket and you go to the deli section, you know, they're cutting up cold cuts left and right. Three or four guys behind the counter taking turns on the same piece of liverwurst or ham or whatever it might be. And that's not being cooked. You know, it's the same thing. I mean, it might have been cooked at one time, but it's not being cooked when they cut it up and they hand it out. They all have masks. They all have gloves. Before the virus, they all had gloves anyway. But now they have masks and gloves. So I guess you're rolling the dice with that too. But I'm not worried about it. I've been doing it. Back to you.
Okay, I mean, you know, we all decide on our level of risk. I think that the cold cuts are a little bit less risky because when you buy it, you don't consume it immediately, or you don't have to consume it immediately. So just the process of refrigerating it for a day or so kind of improves your odds significantly, whereas you're not really going to do that with sushi, so at least not to my knowledge.
Well, no problem there. I don't eat sushi, so. But, okay, very good. Back to you, Roy.
Okay. I mean, likewise. My uncle was sold fish, so I don't know. That might have colored my opinion of fish to this day. Anyway, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra Roy with the Limarck Tactical Net. If anyone else has any opinions regarding the risk one takes with different delivery foods, especially sushi and such, please give us your opinion. Okay, well, I guess we kind of hit that topic. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limarck Technical Net. And if you have any questions of a technical nature, any topics you would like to discuss tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign.
WS2M, Paul.
Yes, Paul.
It's been talked about on the news that it's possible for these people, you know, you get your power on after these after this disaster, you get your power on, and then a neighbor has a generator backfeeding his own house, you know, without a transfer switch, and PSE&G turns it on, turns the power on, you know, and they finally get to them, and the generator is still running, and somehow it winds up in the neighbor's house. The overvoltage winds up in the neighbor's house, and you know, even so, that guy didn't do anything. He winds up with a fried panel. Have you heard anything like that?
No, I haven't. I guess legally you're required to have a main breaker triggered before you start to back power your generator, but perhaps not everyone observes that rule.
Yeah, understood. You know, that's the problem. You know, transfer switches are the way to go, but, you know, in this type of situation, somebody will hook it up, backfeed the house, rather than just, you know, run a couple of cables through the house. And I think that's how they get themselves into trouble. But, okay. They said it's happened, so I've heard of one case, but actually the news has talked about it. So, yeah, when you hook up your generators, if you have a generator, either run cables through the house or you better be able to, you know, make sure your power's shut off, your mains are shut off, if you're gonna backfeed the house. It's kind of a dangerous way to go. Just, you know, one mistake, you know, turning the mains on and having the power going at the same time, and then PSE&G, you know, turns their system on, and you could have a major problem. Back to you, Roy.
Well, that's good advice. You should always be vigilant if you're going to back power. It's a dicey proposition. You really need a transfer switch. You need to kind of cut any possibility of electrocuting your neighbors or some technician working nearby. I remember for years listening on the technical net where this was discussed and rediscussed, and people would come on and discuss their transfer switching methods and such. And get an electrician to do it probably is the smartest move. I don't even know if legally you can do that by yourself, but it's dangerous to just back power. So thanks for bringing that up, Paul.
WD2EAG.
Yes, Ed.
The problem is that the mains and the generator are at the same voltage, but the phase relationship is arbitrary. And there's a 1 in a million chance you'll catch it just right, won't have any problem, and they'll go into phase lock. But 999,999 out of a million, you're going to blow up your panel. It's basically a double-sided short circuit.
Oh, that's gonna put a lot of sparks in the air.
Comment?
There is a way to do it. If you have a three-phase generator and you want to swing to the line, and this is what the solar home stuff does. There's a way of waiting until the two are, you know, walk through each other in phase. You wait till they're lined up, you're at 000, and then you throw the switch.
Okay, very good. Someone wanted to make a comment.
QSL, this is Warren, AC2KY. Good evening. Paul brings up a good report, good point. I was actually going to bring it up tonight myself. I'm an electrician, and a lot of people are under the, you know, it happens. It's not every day, but when you de-energize your main and you close in the 2-pole 30, in most cases, people with small generators, sometimes that main switch, even though you opened it, is not open. It's closed because of contacts. These circuit breakers are not bulletproof. So, Roy, your point about having a transfer switch is well taken. Did I explain that correctly? So a circuit breaker is not necessarily off when it's off. You got to check it with a meter.
Good, Warren, that's a very good point. I mean, again, this has kind of been talked about before in the technical net, and I found it interesting every time I heard about the transfer switches. Yeah. Belt and suspenders, I think, is kind of the concept here, that you don't want to take any risks. So I appreciate your additional insight into this. Okay, hopefully we covered that. Anyone else with any questions? I have a question from the chat room, actually. Matthew, KD2TNS, has an interesting question that I haven't thought about. He wanted to know if there's a DMR HT setup that is Linux-friendly. I'm assuming he means by that the CPS software that's used to generate the code plugs. Unfortunately, I do all my work on Windows these days. I do believe that there are Linux versions that sort of work as CPS. I'd be curious if there are people out there who are Linux gurus or at least have a little bit more experience than I, of any DMR radio CPS software that comes in Linux flavor in addition to Windows and Mac OS.
WQBZ.
Yes, Rich.
I do know that 95% of it is Windows and Mac based. In fact, most of it is Windows based. But I think there is a clue. I think there is a variation of it in Linux. I can't tell you what it is right now, but I will. I'll Google it and come back in a bit.
Okay, very good. I did a cursory look through Google, found something called DMR Config, that they call is Configuration Utility for DMR Radios, and it's on GitHub. So Matt, if not familiar, although I'm sure you must have Googled it before, you might want to check that out. Again, it's called DMR Config, one word, and that should be on GitHub. But if anyone else has any ideas of a CPS-like program that's designed to work on Linux instead of Windows, like the rest of us guys, please give us your call sign. Okay, nothing heard. Well, hopefully Rich will get back to us and if he finds any additional software that serves that purpose. Again, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. My name is Roy, Romeo Oscar Yankee, and I am net control for the Limemark Technical Net. We meet here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. and been doing it since 1982, and we continue to do it here today. So, once again, if anyone has any questions of a technical nature or topics they would like to discuss tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign.
City 20 GB Mobile. Nothing at the moment, but I had something in mind. I just got to pull it out of my brain.
Okay, very well, Craig. What probably we'll do is I will ask Andy to come here and do Andy's Corner, and hopefully at the end of Andy's Corner, I'll ask you again, and you'll tell us what your question for tonight is. So, Andy, WA2CDM, are you out there?
Yes, here I am. WA2CDL, let me just get organized.
Roy, W2BZ. Did you mention DMR config? Is that the one you said?
Yes, Rich. That's the only one so far that I've been able to find.
Same here. DMR config. Take a look at, like Roy said, at GitHub.
Okay. So, welcome everyone to the Technical Med again. And my name is Andy, WA2CDL, and you are entering my little room where I'm in the corner of the room. And I'm listening to myself, by the way. And I call it Andy's Corner. So, we don't take up much space because the corner is rather small. But maybe over time we'll have a larger corner. So, a little pun there. We have to humor ourselves in, with what's going on in this crazy environment that we live in. I hope everyone survived the storm without too much, too many events. I got lucky because my power went out for just about a 2 minute window, and that was it. And it was clarified the reason why that happened, which makes sense. But there are people to this day who are still waiting for power to come back. And I know how frustrating that could be, how angry people can get. And I know there's been a lot of talk about that. And as far as the storm, I have to say that it, the way I see it, it caught us off guard. I did not expect the storm to be as powerful as it turned out to be. I don't think anybody did. And in fact, just a little bit of history, I think I was watching the forecast and they were talking about the storm, you know, hugging the coast and coming up. But then they said it was going to hit landfall, I think in Virginia or South Carolina. And then once it makes landfall, it was going to, they said, it, one forecast said it was going to stay over land. And then as it goes further up, further north, it's going to lose its strength. And by the time it gets here, we'll have, you know, we'll have some gusty winds, but not hurricane force winds, which we did have, by the way. There were wind speeds that were clocked over 80 miles an hour. So anyway, the thing is, it didn't lose its much of its strength. And actually, when it was in Jersey, coming up that coast, it was still 70 miles plus wind speeds. So I guess that's it's kind of unusual. But again, there was I heard an explanation that had to do with a front causing extra wind shear or something. I don't know if we have any meteorologists out there or anyone studies that, but maybe they can explain why it did not lose its strength over land, which you would think that it would.
Repeater, timeout.
NY2H.
Repeater, timed out.
Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I was waiting for the timeout. Sorry about that, I'm talking too much. Go ahead, Lou, I got you.
All right, so RLP should be reconnected now. Refresh your page, Roy, and should be okay.
Yep, we're back on.
Okay, I got to remember, Lou, the timer's a three-minute timer. Did I talk for 3 minutes? It doesn't feel like 3 minutes. Is that what it said for, Lou, three minutes?
Sounded more like 4.5 minutes.
Affirmative.
I can't believe I was talking that long. All right. Okay, anyway, let's get on with this. I just had to say about the storm because I was surprised, and I think a lot of people were. So that's why we have what we have now. Anyway, so this is going to be a continuation of what I started last week. And this Andy's Corner is going to be on impedance matching. And it's an article, if anybody's following along, in October 2019 QST, and it's by Ward Silver, N0AX, and he does quite a few of these articles. By the way, I'm hearing a lot of static on the computer. Okay, so last week we went into impedance explained, what it is. I'm not going to go into the whole dissertation of what I spoke about last week. I'm going to continue because there's it gets pretty involved, and there's another article after this one, and that goes into matching transformers using coax cable, RF transformers and line transformers of RF impedance matching. Because when you think about it, you know, impedances are matched in many different areas in electronic circuits. As an example, and I think most people will understand this, your speaker, and I didn't mention this last week, your speaker in your AM/FM clock radio that you bought back in the 50s, everybody knows, or most people know, or should know, that if, especially a ham, if you ask what is the ohmage of the speaker in your radio, and most people would say it's 8 ohms. 8 ohms, for whatever reason, became a standard of a of an impedance. It's not a resistance, by the way, it's an impedance. And that's an interesting concept, because if you measure the resistance with an ohmmeter, you're not going to see it at 8 ohms. You're going to see less than an ohm. But the impedance of your speaker in your radio is 8 ohms. That's a, there's also 16 ohms, there's 32 ohms, and there's a certain ratio, a certain number system that they came up with for impedance of transformers, of speakers, loudspeakers. So, now, attached to that speaker is a transformer. And what is...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, that's... Just remind me to stop talking. I'm talking too much. W-H-C-D-O. Attached to a speaker, and most... If you've ever taken a radio apart, you see a little transformer that's actually riveted to the speaker. And that transformer happens to be an impedance-matching transformer because the output impedance of the radio itself is not 8 ohms. It's a lot higher. And there's also transformers that are called line-to-voice coil. Maybe you've heard that terminology. It's used in, you know, PA systems throughout buildings where you have multiple speakers. And that's a whole another field which we could talk about later on. But the point that I'm making is that, you know, impedance matching is very, it's a broad subject that covers many areas. Anything from RF to audio, to antennas. You want to match your antenna impedance. And you have different ways of matching. You have resistive matching, reactive matching, transformer matching, transmission line matching, and so on. So tonight, I'm going to go into resistive, what I didn't cover last week. I spoke about transformers with cores. I'm not going to go into the math. There's a little bit of math involved. I'll talk about resistive matching, and then reactive matching, and then some networks, which are L networks, T networks, Pi networks, and so on, and that's also used for matching. And that's used in your transmitter. Or and receiver, by the way. All right, let me let it drop. Wait for the video. By the way, is WB2EAD listening? Right, you're out there?
Late checking?
Here I am, but this is...
I didn't hear you, Ed. You got noisy, because there's a lot of noise on the repeater. And there's a late check-in. Was a late check-in?
Roger, roger. This is KC2QYW. Joe from Harrison, New York.
Okay, Joe, as Roy would say, welcome aboard. The technical net, and this is Andy's corner, my little corner that you just walked into. Okay, Ed, I didn't hear what you said. The reason why I'm mentioning your name, Ed, is because you can interject anything you want as I go along with this. I know you had a couple of things you wanted to say. Ed, I noticed, again, there's a lot of static on the video. Ed, are you copying me? Go ahead.
I have to call them IHT, and dinner is running late, so I'm kind of half mystified. I'll do the best I can to eavesdrop. And if there's something I can't pull myself back on, I'll let you know.
I only copied a little bit of that. Your signal's not strong, and the static's taking you out, so I think you said you have to leave to go eat. It's just don't drop it. Is that what you said?
I am monitoring while I eat.
Oh, got that. You're monitoring while you eat. Okay, fine. Okay. All right, very good. So, sorry for the static, guys. We're going to have to look into that. It's funny, I didn't hear the static earlier. My signal, let's see, I'm on high power. So let's see if we can make the best of this. So I spoke about transformers with cores. And I mentioned, you know, just a little bit of... a little bit of a review going back to what I spoke about. So in RF applications, there's different core materials, usually ferrite or powdered iron. And because these materials can store and transfer nearly all of the RF energy and they work well at high power levels, dissipating little energy as heat. Because they work over a wide frequency range, these are considered broadband transformers. And there is no direct or galvanic connection between the two windings. Thus, can also act as an isolation transformer to block common mode current. By the way, it mentioned isolation. Isolation transformer is another transformer. But it's used not as an impedance matching transformer, but it's used for isolation. I use it to isolate one side of the line, and this is something that could be dangerous. There was a time where the plug on your radio was what they call a non-polarized plug. If you notice, the plug on equipment that you buy, if it's not a three-pronged plug, if it doesn't have a ground, you'll see a wide blade and a narrow blade. And usually the narrow blade is the hot side, believe it or not, and the wide blade is the neutral side. And it's set up so you can't turn the plug around. It only goes in one way. There used to be a time where these plugs were... it's called a polarized plug. There used to be a time where the plugs were non-polarized and you could turn them around, and actually one side of the line went right to the chassis. And if you happen to have do some troubleshooting, let's say with an oscilloscope, and you take your ground probe, you know, the one...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Comment?
Yeah, I knew there would be some old-timers out there that would comment on this one. Go ahead, comment. I'm sorry about the timeout. I'm talking too much.
Oh, yeah, I'm an old-timer, a rocking 52 years old. KD2CXK, it's Craig, Andy. How are you? Glad you're picking up the reins here. Yeah, do you know the reason why they had a hot chassis? There's one reason only.
Well, these chassis did not use any transformers. It just rectified the line, as far as I know. And it was, of course, a lot lighter because they didn't have any iron that would weigh it down. I mean, that's one reason. The filaments were in series with each other, usually. And if you added up the filament voltage, it would come up to the line voltage because of the filaments of the tubes I'm talking about. Obviously, you know, tube-type equipment. So like a 50C5, a 35W4, and all that stuff. So that's what I know on these hot chassis. The Holocraft is S120 receiver was an example of that. I believe it had a hot chassis when they made it. This was a very popular receiver. Back to you, Craig. Go ahead with your input on that.
You're partially correct. The number one reason was cost. Back in the 50s and the 60s, where most of these hot chassis radios were produced, actually it goes all the way back to the 30s, the transformer was the most expensive part of the radio. So by eliminating the transformer, they could take the line voltage and in series go between all five tubes. They were able to get these down to five tubes. And then the right tubes in combination would, all the filaments would equal 110 or 117 volts of the line voltage. And that's why those radios are called the Big Five. And they were made by anybody from Motorola to Philco, like you mentioned, Holocrafters. You can go down the list, names you probably haven't heard in 30 years. But it all came down to the transformer being the most expensive part of the radio. And the chassis themselves were metal framed, but isolated from the Bakelite or additional metal cabinet through rubberized standoffs. And they usually had warnings in the back. But of course, those are all gone. KD2, CXK, back to net.
Okay, if you hear me okay, the noise. Ed, go ahead with a comment. Go ahead, Ed, WA2CDO with a comment.
Yeah, those five tube radios all had different heater voltages. They all ran at the same current because they were in series. And the voltage was proportional to how much power you need. The audio output was always the most powerful tube. That's why they had a 50C5. That at 50 volts was almost half the power of the radio. And the filament, and the heater would run course with that. They all used the same tube lineup, regardless of manufacturer.
Okay, you're right. And I mentioned what you guys are saying. I mentioned about the filaments being in series. I don't want to get too far off the beaten path. The only reason why I brought this up is because I mentioned transformers and the different types of transformers. And an isolation transformer I would use when I would service a radio like this type. To prevent me getting electrocuted, because what it would do is it would isolate the line, isolate the hot chassis from the equipment that I'm using to test, like the test equipment. So it would do to an isolation transformer. And what an isolation transformer does, it simply is a one-to-one ratio winding. So it does not increase or decrease the voltage from primary to secondary, nor does it increase or decrease the current. It just isolates, as it says, as the statement says, it's an isolation transformer. And I got a bunch of those. A variac, by the way, if anybody uses a variac, does not completely isolate. A variac actually has one side connected directly to the line. So you got to be careful when you use a variac. It's a partial isolation, but not really. And we can talk about that. Anyway, all right, so, and thanks for the input on that. Yeah, that radio, by the way, was called an All-American 5 because it used 5 tubes, just like you said. And the 50C5 was a beam-powered tube and was popular as an audio output tube. Again, getting into impedance, if you look up the specifications for these tubes, you'll see that the impedance of the tube does not match the impedance of the transformer that it drives. So I'll just repeat that. It does not match the impedance of let me just repeat that because I didn't say it right. The impedance of the tube does not match the speaker that it drives. So the output impedance of the tube is much higher than the speaker because the speaker is usually 8 ohms, as I mentioned. So you need a matching transformer, and that's where the matching transformer comes into play. So the primary impedance of the matching transformer is much higher than the secondary impedance, which is normally 8 ohms to match the speaker to give you a maximum power output. So you'll normally see, and you can see the writing on this, sometimes these transformers are labeled, they have an 8 ohm secondary and a 15,000 ohm or 2,000 ohm or 5,000 ohm primary.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Timeout again. WHCDL, let me just let it drop. Make sure I got a reset. Okay. All right, so there you go with an impedance matching transformer to match your speaker. All right, so I just mentioned isolation transformers, and he also mentioned impedance matching transformers. Now, there's a bunch of figures here, which obviously I can't describe. Transformers come in different ratios or impedances. You got a 4-to-1, you got a 9-to-1, you got a 16-to-1. And this is used in RF applications because you have a certain coax cable with a 50 ohm impedance, and if you have a dipole that's got it's got a 400 ohm impedance. Let's say you want to match your impedances, so you could make a transformer to do that. And the standards are 4-to-1, 9-to-1, 16-to-1, and any ratio you want, depending on how you design the transformer. So there were different types of transformers in regarding balanced to unbalanced balanced to balanced and unbalanced to unbalanced, usually called a UN, an UN transformer, where both the input and output circuits are unbalanced, meaning that they have a common connection to the system's reference voltage, which is, in other words, that'll be ground. That'll actually be a ground condition. So a transformer can also act as a balun, which transfers power between a balanced feed line or load, that means both conductors are symmetric with respect to ground, and an unbalanced system. So both, if it's a balanced output, both conductors are conducting equal and opposite of each other with respect to ground. All right, so that's dealing with a little bit of RF. Now we're going to go into resistors matching. You can match with resistors. And let me just let it drop so I don't time it out. Okay, another way of matching impedances is just putting a resistor in series or parallel with the impedance to be matched. So if you want to match, say, 18 ohms to 50 ohms, you put a 32 ohm resistor in series with it. Or if you have 100 ohms that you want to turn into 50 ohms, you add another 100 ohm in parallel, because 200 ohms and 200 ohm resistors in parallel will have the resistance to make it 50 ohms. So that's one way. Resistor matching is cheap and very broadband, but it has the drawback of dissipating power. You know, again, you want to get the maximum power transfer. You don't want to dissipate power. So in the 18 ohm example, which I just mentioned, for every watt of power that gets to the 18 ohm impedance, 1.8 watts is dissipated by the 32 ohm resistor, which is a four, if you calculate it to dBs, which was the last subject we spoke about, comes out to a 4.4 dB loss from the power source's point of view. In other words, from the source of power to the load, with that kind of match, you're going to get a little over 4 dB loss of power, which is quite a bit. And I'm talking about power. Now, 3 dB is half your power. And this is 4.4 dB. So you're immediately losing half your power right there. All right, let me let it drop. Any questions up to this point? WA2CDO. All right, probably don't have a lot of techs out there, and hope nobody's sleeping, but there might be a few. Okay, so let's see. The popular TFTD folded dipole. TFTD. I gotta think what TF. What does TFTD stand for? The popular. That's a folded dipole. I can't think of the word. Uses a high wattage resistor in a similar way to reduce or swamp out the SWR variation at the feed point, for example. Oh, is that a TFTD? It's on the tip of my tongue, but I can't remember the word. What kind of dipole is that? What's a TFTD dipole, Roy? Because I forget. You know the name?
Not offhand.
Yeah, Lou, do you know offhand?
I got it.
Yeah, go.
Twin folded terminated dipole. 82CXK, back to that.
Oh, what does the first T stand for?
Twin. Tango, Whiskey, Indian November.
Oh, okay. Twin folded, terminated dipole. Okay. Actually, that's not a popular term. Twin folded. Of course, we know what a folded dipole is, but a twin folded. Okay. I think I was thinking of maybe a beverage antenna that's got a termination at one end. But I'm not sure. Antennas were never my strong point, but I just use them. I don't design them or play with them, which I should anyway. All right. So continue resistor matching. You can use an attenuator to match impedances if you're willing to dissipate some power. You know, and there are circuits which I've actually built to do that. You can have matching pads, and there's a thing called a minimum loss matching pad, and there's a formula that you can plug in, and you can actually match impedances by using a matching pad. But it is lossy, and that's the only thing about it. But then there's a way of reducing the loss, and that's why they call it a minimum loss matching pad if you calculate it right. So a good example to use, I should say, a good example is the use of a 50-ohm attenuator at the output of a signal generator. The attenuator reduces impedance variations that can upset the signal generator's output calibration. And you could use T or pi, network attenuator pads if you want, because that can also be used. And the reason why they call it T and pi is the configuration, what it looks like schematically. You know, one will look like a pi configuration, if you know what the symbol pi is. One will look like a T configuration, so the symbol T or the letter T. So you could build a